Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Vibrant Health Solutions Radio Show. I'm your host, Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and each week we bring you cutting-edge information about how you can maintain the best health possible. And I'm really, really excited about our talk today. You guys who've heard me speak before, you know I love talking about insulin and leptin and belly fat and blood sugar, and I am going to be talking today with a very special guest who loves to geek out on those subjects too. So we're going to have a lot of fun, and we're going to educate you, and we're going to really help you to see the way that your belly, your gut bugs, your bacteria, and your hormones affect how you look, how you feel, your energy levels, and your longevity, quite frankly. So there's a lot of stuff that we're going to cover in here, and I'm very excited to welcome Mike Mutzel to our show. And Mike is has a BS in biology from Western Washington University. He's completing his master's in clinical nutrition from the University of Bridgeport, which is my alma mater. And he has written an amazing book called The Belly Fat Effect. And I just got it in the mail today, and I was looking through it and realized he said it's close to 1,800 references in the back of the book. So we know that what he's talking about is well-researched. He didn't pull it out of thin air and make it up. And I'm really excited to welcome to the show today Mike Mutzel. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm so excited to geek out, like you said, on the gut bacteria and belly fat and all the stuff in between.
I know. I was really excited when I went to your website and I saw some of your videos. And I'm like, whoa, I love it, biochemical pathways and stuff. But we don't want to scare people away here. We want to let them know that it's really good to understand what's going on in your body so that you're empowered to make the choices that get you to the health that you want. And I would just love to just jump right in. And first of all, I'd love to start with, how did you get interested in this topic? Because you don't see too much written about all this leptin and belly fat and insulin and the whole gut bug approach.
Sure. Yeah, that's a great point. Well, I mean, I guess sort of it comes from trying to understand my own biology and physiology and trying to optimize physical performance. And I played a lot of sports in high school and in college. And I noticed, you know, we all have, you know, good days and bad days. And we look in the mirror and we look at our cheeks and our stomach. Like, gosh, we look a little chubby. Where is that person from 6 months ago and so forth? And I found this correlation with my own GI issues and body composition. And then I was fortunate enough to work with an integrative doctor in Denver and do nutrition work out of his office. His name is Gerard Guillory of the Care Group, and worked with a lot of metabolic syndrome, type 2 diabetic, pre-diabetic, you know, advanced cardiovascular risk type patients. And I quickly realized that majority, if not all, these individuals had GI issues. And this was back in 2007, 2008. And there wasn't a whole lot of research back then emerging about the link between the gut bacteria and metabolism, but you know, I would go to the medical school library at night. I have a, you know, knack for doing research and trying to really figure out how things come about and, you know, disease processes and systems. And I came across a paper that talked about how bariatric surgery works. And, you know, we all think that bariatric surgery, which, by the way, is one of the most effective ways from a medical standpoint to cause weight loss. And I'm not saying I'm a fan of it. I just admire the mechanism of action, so to speak, and we'll tease out the natural ways that we can mimic the hormonal effect of bariatric surgery later. But back
so
to
just
that.
Go ahead, you know, before you go on, Mike, just make sure you clarify for people what that may not know what bariatric surgery is.
Great point. So there's many different names: gastric bypass, bariatric surgery. So this is what a lot of morbidly obese individuals tend to resort to when they go through the traditional medical system and can't lose weight and have a lot of health complications as a result. And so what it basically entails, there's a couple different forms of gastric bypass or bariatric surgery. And basically it's manipulating the intestine in various different ways. And in so doing, there's a dramatic reduction in weight loss, belly fat, improvement in diabetes-like symptoms. And a lot of people, including myself, used to think that the way that bariatric surgery causes weight loss is because you're restricting how much food people can eat. But actually what the science shows, which really intrigued me and, you know, caused me to write a book on this topic, was that's not how bariatric surgery causes rapid weight loss. It's actually changing, number one, the composition of this gut microbiome inside our intestines, which is this collective body of microorganisms that outnumber the number of cells in our human body tenfold. And bariatric surgery also changes the gut hormones released from our small intestine. And these hormones are so powerful, we can dive into the details of this. But these hormones are upstream from the critical insulin and glucagon and all these blood sugar, fat-sensing, fat-regulatory, appetite-sensing hormones. So it really opened up my eyes to look at this from a whole new perspective and go, oh my gosh, the first contact point of food in the body is the gut. The gut is communicating to the rest of the body. And if you're eating junky food at the wrong time and you're not chewing your food, you're going to have gut dysfunction. And then guess what? You're going to have belly fat. You're going to be overweight. You're going to have appetite issues. So that's a long-winded way of kind of how I got into this and was motivated to write the book.
Wow. Wow. So, you know, we'd love to hear more about the gut, its metabolic processes, some of these hormones, and how that relates to belly fat and blood sugar.
Absolutely. Well, let's just start out with, let's pretend that we're sitting down and having a meal together. You know, the sight, smell, taste of food is going to trigger regions in our brain to tell our GI tract, which would then speak to the rest of the body to let the body know that nutrients are coming in and prepare the body to digest, receive, absorb, and then process these nutrients. But the challenge is, as you know, Dr. Rita Marie, so many people are eating while they're stressed out. They're not eating healthy meals during the morning and at lunchtime, and that's when your GI tract is so receptive. People are eating big meals at night in front of the television. They're stressed. They're not chewing their food. So they're not sending the proper messages to their brain that a meal is coming in. Moreover, they're causing maldigestion from not chewing their food or eating food mindlessly, which we can talk about. Just the act of chewing, it sounds so basic, but you can take two people that eat, you know, they have different metabolisms, you know, granted, but let's say, you know, I sit down next to you and we have a meal and I don't chew my food and you chew 40 chews per bite. I'm going to have a much higher post-meal insulin and glucose response than you would. So it's not only what you eat, it's how you eat it. What's your psychological state while you're eating? And this is, you know, foundation step number one before we even get into carbs, proteins, fats, calories, all that is just sitting down, being very mindful when you are eating at the table and chewing about once per minute, or sorry, swallowing once per minute. So really chewing that food, masticating it, that act of chewing is going to stimulate your brain centers to speak to your gut so that your gut will release the proper hormones. And that's kind of the next step I'd like to go. And we think about insulin and cortisol and all these hormones, and they're so important. But the gut releases a type of about 24 different hormones that are responsible for suppressing our appetite, for balancing our blood sugar. They raise or lower blood lipids, so in a sense they help us burn or store fat. And so on, they actually govern about 54% of insulin's activity. So, so many people right now are focusing on low glycemic index, avoiding sugar, getting low calories and so forth, which are all important. But if your gut is not sending the right messages to the rest of your body through these incretin hormones, you can likely have insulin resistance. And I'm not the only one saying this. Actually, if you look at the pipeline of diabetic drug companies, they're all focusing on hormonal analogs that are produced by the gut because they realize that this is an upstream mechanism for restoring blood sugar regulation, for restoring appetite and lipid balance. So it's very fascinating. There's a lot of drugs right now, Januvia, Byetta in different forms, and they actually go after these two hormones that we can dive into, CCK, known as cholecystokinin, or GLP-1. And, again, I'm not necessarily a fan of these drugs, but I just like to admire their mechanism and say, okay, what natural compounds do we have that also release these two hormones? And things like whey protein, pea protein, curcumin, resveratrol, and inulin from chicory are natural ways that we can mimic the hormonal effect of these drugs, which have a lot of side effects. So the good news is we have so many natural ways and strategies to rebalance our blood sugar through the gut and correct the underlying metabolic dysfunction that so many people experience today.
Whoa, that was a mouthful, and it's awesome stuff. And it's interesting that the drug companies are shifting gears from things like metformin and other things that affect liver into actually affecting the gut versus directly going after insulin receptors.
Very true. I thought that was really fascinating as well. But get this, a new study came out that showed that metformin, which if we look at the cellular biochemistry, like how does metformin really improve blood sugar regulation and insulin signaling? It used to be thought that it was through the PPAR system and so on, but new research shows that metformin also affects these gut hormones, the one that I mentioned called GLP-1. And also metformin affects the gut microbiome. And this is hot new science that came out in the last 60 days. So again, it all comes back to the gut. We're refining, you know, unearthing, if you will, these scientific ways by which blood sugar is really controlled at a much higher level than just focusing on low glycemic index or nutrients that I'm a fan of, but like, you know, cinnamon and chromium and green tea. Those things are very beneficial, but I think it's good to take a step back and focus on the gut first so that we really get at the root cause of why people are having body composition issues and blood sugar dysregulation.
Wow. So you're going through these hormones. Tell us how these hormones affect the gut bacteria.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, so here's the thing. Let's just go back and talk about the gut bacteria and just define this real quick, just so we're all on the same page. When you hear the word the microbiome or microflora or gut bacteria, what that refers to is, and this is what scientists call it, the forgotten organ. Okay, literally this collective organism, if you will, is as metabolically active as one of our most metabolically active organs in our body called the liver. So that's how powerful this microbiome is. They help us detox. They help us extract more energy from our food, which can be beneficial if you're eating vegetables, but not so beneficial if you're eating McDonald's, which we'll talk about. They help us digest polyphenols, so things like curcumin, resveratrol, red wine, kale, spinach. If you didn't have these 100 trillion bacteria in your gut, you couldn't break down these healthy foods. So they're very advantageous, but the problem is when we feed them the standard American diet, the processed canola oil, safflower oil, corn oil, soy oil, and then also processed carbohydrates. We selectively increase the type of bacteria that make us fat, and at the same time, we decrease the healthy bacteria that make us lean. So it's a double whammy, if you will. In contrast, when we eat a diet rich in polyphenols, which would be red wine, blueberries, raspberries, teas and herbs and spices, onions, garlic, all these things, we actually increase a type of bacteria called Bacteroidetes. And this is a family, if you will, a phyla of bacteria that contain enzymes that help us break down these healthy foods and so forth. So just eating a diet rich in color, rich in fiber, you can turn your microbiome into a fat-fighting, diabetes-fighting organism, if you will. So that's why they're so important. But back to your original question, how do they affect the gut hormones, which is a great, great point. Well, the gut bacteria are, they live in and on our intestinal lining, and as such, are communicating to the cells on our intestinal lining. And there's one particular cell type, not to get too scientific, but it's called the L cell. So this is a specialized cell that has little receptors, and it's constantly, you know, feeling and figuring out the environment. And gut bacteria can speak to this L cell, and this L cell releases all these good hormones that, again, the diabetes drug companies are going after and that bariatric surgery increases. So one particular genre of bacteria that's been shown to really increase actually the number of L cells and the activity of these L cells is Bifidobacterium. And so that's why I'm such a fan of this when it comes to restoring metabolism, burning fat, and so on, is supplementing with Bifidobacterium, because for whatever reason, it can speak to these L cells more powerfully than other strains, and in so doing, it's linked with better better metabolic control and appetite control.
Wow. You know, it's interesting that you say that, because when I run stool tests on people to assess their gut health, inevitably I find people that they're low in bifidobacter. They're fine oftentimes in lactobacillus, and possibly because that's what the most common strain is that's out there in the probiotic supplements, and they're taking them. But I see this over and over again, that people are low in bifidobacter.
Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot, and actually the reason why I like to harp on bifido is there's a ton of research supporting it. But in contrast, when you look at the data, a study just came out in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and they looked at diabetic patients in Japan. And what they found is that lactobacilli in the stool correlated positively with type 2 diabetes. And so that doesn't really mean that lactobacillus causes diabetes, but the data is a lot more mixed when it comes to, okay, is lactobacillus really good for us or bad for us? Is it linked with disease or not? Well, study after study is showing that it's kind of in that gray area. That doesn't mean stop your probiotic, but just take a probiotic that has a higher relative amount of bifidobacterium, because I've looked at a lot of these different research studies, and not one has shown any contraindication or correlation with elevated bifidobacterium and metabolic disease.
Okay. So getting back to the hormone thing, I want to see this connection. So the bifidobacter then promote the hormones, the CCK, et cetera, that you said are going to be protective and help the fat burning?
That's right. It's not just the bacteria. It's actually the nutrients that we eat, too. So what's really unique, again, these L cells, they have these receptors. And when we think of things like taste buds, you know, if we were to go have a sour kombucha or a sweet Skittles or sugar or something, these different taste buds, we think that they're just in the mouth. But these taste buds are actually found throughout the GI tract. No kidding, in our pancreas, in our heart, in our brain. And they pick up on bitter and sweet, sour, savory compounds or, you know, throughout the body. So here's what's really unique about this is if certain proteins, for example, can lock onto these taste buds in our GI tract and stimulate the production of these beneficial hormones. One of them, for example, one compound which I love, and I'm sure you use this clinically, is berberine. It's
mm-hmm.
a potent, this, the data for berberine and how it affects waist circumference, postprandial insulin response, fasting glucose, hemoglobin A1C, everything you can think of is for a natural compound. I don't think there's anything that can even come close to it. But it's a very potent alkaloid. It's a bitter compound. And the studies have shown that this is able to speak to these L cells, just like the bacteria do, and beneficially increase the release of these potent gut hormones. And in so doing, affect our metabolism in a positive way. So other compounds too, curcumin is one of them, resveratrol. And although it hasn't been studied, I would say onions, anything that's bitter and kind of has a strong taste or odor, we know communicates with these cells in our intestine and, again, has a positive effect on our metabolism. So, you know, the take-home message here is just focus on just a lot of color, herbs, and spices. The bland pasta, white bread, you know, soda pop, that doesn't have these beneficial bioactives, and it's devoid of, you know, the vitamin P, the phytochemicals, if you will. And that's really, if we look at, you know, a healthy diet, a low glycemic index diet, that's at the core. And we now know that it's doing a lot more than just so-called being an antioxidant. It's speaking to the gut cells, which affect our metabolism, help us burn fat, and balance our blood sugar.
Wow, this is cool stuff. So, wow. So another thing I wanted to ask you about. So you're bringing up a lot of questions floating in my mind, because there's a lot of different ways of looking at things. And one of the things that's become popular recently is something called the specific carbohydrate diet, the FODMAPs diets, which are restricting a lot of these things. Some of them you're talking about, like onions are off, and garlic is off, and inulin is off. Can you address that and how the controversy might come about there?
Yeah, great point. Yeah, so this diet is not for everyone that I'm recommending. And I recently did a podcast with, I'm sure you know his name, Steven Sandberg Lewis, and he's a big small intestinal bacteria overgrowth researcher. And, you know, what we basically talked about is, you know, a lot of people have impaired GI motility. And, you know, the valves separating, say, the stomach in the small intestine or the small intestine in the colon are not really functioning properly. They have what's called low tone. So we're seeing reflux, which we shouldn't, you know, from the colon into the small intestine or the small intestine into the stomach. And so we're getting relative numbers of the proportion of bacteria is increasing in the small intestine, and that's creating an environment where more things are being fermented and they shouldn't be in the small intestine. And so that's causing challenges like intestinal permeability or dysbiosis or, you know, constipation, diarrhea, bad breath, autoimmune disease. I mean, the list goes on. And so this is a very real phenomenon, and it affects about, according to Steven Sandberg Lewis, about, you know, 60 to 70% of individuals with IBS. If we look at the general population, that's a probably 10 to 15% of the general population, maybe more. So if you experience discomfort from polyphenolic fiber-rich foods that we've been discussing, definitely avoid them and restore your gut first, the gut microbiome, and we can talk about ways that you can do that. Berberine is actually indicated. It's one of these natural compounds. But to be honest, I don't know exactly what causes this. What's chicken or the egg? Is it a genetic thing? Is it a food thing? Is it exposure to antibiotics? You know, Dr. Steven Sandberg Lewis will tell you that a lot of these patients have previously taken opiate-based pain meds before, whether not necessarily recreational, maybe before or after a surgical procedure. And these opiate compounds slow down the GI motility or the movement, the peristalsis of the GI tract. And in so doing, we get this reflux, and the proportion of bacteria from the colon in, you know, make their way into the small intestine and rise. And then we're getting kind of an overactivity on the foods that we eat that is causing these challenges, like you mentioned. So I think it's very important to recognize that. And again, it goes back to this. I would recommend most people try this diet, high fiber, high polyphenol. But if you experience adverse symptoms initially, then back off and see an integrative functional medicine practitioner that can evaluate this, treat this, and don't ignore it, because you could be adding fuel to the fire, which we don't want to do.
Absolutely. That's great advice. That's great advice. Because, you know, a majority of people that I put on a high-fiber, high antioxidant-rich diet, similar to what you're talking about, do phenomenally. But then we have the people who they blend up some greens and they're drinking a really potent green smoothie, and most people do well with it, and it just irritates the heck out of their gut. So these are probably those folks that have some of that motility issues and the valve issues and the low tone, and are probably having some trouble there. So you mentioned that there are approaches to restoring that function before then going on to do the rest of this. So tell us more about that.
Sure. Yeah, the restoration, I think in 5 years, Dr. Rita Marie will be doing what's called, you know, fecal microbiota transplantation, and literally taking stool supernatant or just the bacterial slurry from healthy people and injecting it rectally into our colon and restoring our gut microbiome that way. I think that's where the science is really going. But right now what we have is probiotics, and we have herbs and botanicals, natural things that we can use to eradicate the bacteria that just love the standard American diet. To eradicate those guys and bring in more good guys that love the fibers, love the color, the spinach, the kale, the broccoli. And so things, berberine is one of them. Oil of oregano is another natural compound that's really good. Caprylic acid is one that has a lot of research on it. So those are things that I tend to look at, and we would generally recommend. But first, we would want to, you know, do some sort of testing. And there's various companies now that have the various breath tests to see if people are fermenting, making, you know, these secondary compounds that are causing the overgrowth of bacteria. But one simple assessment strategy, if you're sitting there thinking, okay, do I have imbalances in my gut microbiome, is just ask yourself, how were you born? You know, were you born via C-section or vaginal delivery? Because babies that are born via C-section, tend to have higher prevalences of GI disorders because their gut is not colonized with the healthy bifido and lactobacilli from the mother's vagina and anal cavity, actually. So what we see is these babies instead are colonized by the bacteria found in ambient air in the hospital, which would be Clostridium difficile and Staphylococcus aureus, which are very pro-inflammatory. They're not really the nice guys. So we're, you know, these children, unfortunately, are their immune system is being educated by some bad characters at an early state, and that's affecting their body. Early life exposure to antibiotics is a big one. And just yesterday, the JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, published a study linking childhood antibiotic exposure to obesity. And that's the third time that a major medical established journal has linked early life antibiotics with chronic disease. And the last thing we look at, or someone can ask themselves, you know, if they have GI issues and are wondering if it's their gut bacteria, is were they breastfed or formula fed? So we know breast milk is like perfect in terms of, you know, fuel for a little baby's healthy gut. It has prebiotics, which are the fuel for growing good bacteria. And breast milk actually also has probiotic bacteria. And so babies that are not breastfed tend to have imbalances in their gut, in their microbiome, and also a higher incidence of autoimmunity, allergies, skin disorders, GI disorders, and so on. So those are kind of things that I like to recommend to people is just think back. You know, if you don't know, talk to your parents and see. And then lastly, the medications like we discussed, for example, the pain meds, you know, the opiates, those cause GI issues. The other category would be the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, ibuprofen, Advil, they're called NSAIDs. Those not only cause changes in your gut microbiome, but they cause leaky gut, which we can dive into, and that's a whole other can of worms and is why a lot of people, I think, have belly fat. And then the proton pump inhibitors, so the H2 blockers and so forth, Nexium and the purple pill, they cause a whole slew of digestive dysfunction. And by suppressing stomach acid, we have overgrowth of all kinds of bad bacteria, which cause inflammation, cause leaky gut. So those are some things that I think a lot of people, if they sit down and say, and I have a checklist, I think it's chapter 9 of Belly Fat Effect, where, you know, there's, I think, 13 questions, and you can go through all of those. And, you know, if you answer yes to a lot of these things, well, you probably have some sort of imbalance in your gut bacteria and intestinal lining and gut hormones. And that doesn't mean that you're doomed. There's things you can absolutely do in your life and change to improve that. But if you're sitting there trying to lose weight, trying to balance your blood sugar, and you're eating all the right foods, and you're exercising, and you're really not getting anywhere, I think this is the next step, is really looking at the gut at a deeper level and then changing your diet, changing your probiotic consumption, increasing prebiotics, and so on.
Whoa, lots to do. You know, it's very empowering when people know that there's a lot to do, because we've all been there. I know I wasn't a C-section, but I wasn't breastfed, you know, and I know people who are C-section and not breastfed, so there's the double whammy, and then fed the standard, you know, formula with the loads of sugar, which throws off the biome even more, you know, followed by the chocolate cake on their first birthday, and it's a prescription for disaster, really, the way that the standard approach to raising babies is.
It's sad, and that's why when you go around to public places nowadays, you see a lot of these overweight children. I mean, everywhere I go, I'm in the Midwest right now. I live in Seattle. I was in Florida earlier, and it's really scary. I was, you know, remember growing up, and I don't. We were active. We were running around, and you know, the prevalence of C-section delivered babies was about a third of what it is now. It's about 30 to 40% of all children born in the U.S. today are delivered via C-section. And in, you know, high affluent areas, the number is even higher, which is scary. So it's a tough thing, and that's why I'm really passionate about this, because if we're going to break the vicious cycle of obesity, which I think we have a lot of work to do, you know, we need to start with children and educate them and so forth, because, you know, you have these children that are getting adult diseases at, you know, age 4 and 6 and so forth, which is really scary. It's going to be very metabolically expensive, very medically expensive, and can really affect our economy and our healthcare system. So that's really one thing that drives me to spread the knowledge and the awareness on this so we can all make better choices to enhance our society.
Wow. Well, we all appreciate it. It's great research, and it's great sharing these perspectives. So another thing that came up as you were speaking about that, oh, H. pylori, when you talked about the stomach acid and the Nexium and all that, does H. pylori play a role in this?
You know, H. pylori is kind of mixed, actually. I know in natural medicine, a lot of practitioners love to get rid of H. pylori, but some studies actually show that it's protective. So I'm honestly kind of, I don't know where to, you know, put my foot on this one. But to answer your question, you know, proton pump inhibitors do increase the growth of H. pylori. And we know that people that take PPIs have more challenges. And H. pylori is one of these bacteria that contain endotoxin. And so that's something we can talk about. But basically, these gram-negative type bacteria, they have on their cell surface this protein lipid structure called endotoxin, also known as lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. And this is a really nasty compound. It directly stimulates the immune system in a bad way and causes inflammation. And it's linked with pretty much every disease that you can think of: heart disease, cancer, diabetes, neurologic disorders. It's really nasty. So one way that H. pylori can be bad is possibly through this endotoxin absorption. But there's other studies showing that individuals that are overweight, that if they have H. pylori, it's protective. So I don't really know exactly where to stand on that. But I think what the data clearly shows is that if you have a lot of endotoxin-containing bacteria in a gut, in your gut, and or leaky gut, intestinal permeability, then that's really setting you up for increased risk for belly fat and diabetes and all these different things.
So it's sad when you watch, I'm sure you see it all the time, is the people who are just, they're doing the old calories in, calories out equation of, look, I'm eating, you know, 1,200 calorie a day diet, why am I not losing weight, without really taking into effect this. And you even say that dieting can increase weight gain. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. Again, this is mainstream medical journals. I think one of them was New England Journal of Medicine. The other was Archives of Internal Medicine. And they tracked individuals that did just what you said, Dr. Rita-Marie, did a 1,200-calorie diet for 12 weeks. Okay, but this research team actually looked at a step further. They not only looked at blood sugar, body composition, belly fat, they looked at the levels of these powerful gut hormones that we've been speaking of, GLP-1 and CCK. They tracked them before the study, after the study, and they even followed and circled around 60 weeks later, so over a year later. Guess what they found? Those hormone levels, the powerful gut hormones, were decreased over for the course of the 12-week study, but through the entire year. So when individuals really starve themselves and undergo these low-calorie type diets, they end up causing semi-permanent suppression of these gut hormones. And so what this research team went further, and they did additional studies and found that individuals that have done a lot of yo-yo type dieting, so, you know, the folks, you know, January 1st, they make the resolution, they're going to really cut down the calories, and then they bounce around for the whole year and keep doing it year over year. These individuals have permanent alterations and reductions in these powerful hormones. And What are the side effects associated with that, if you will? The consequences: increased appetite, insulin resistance, increased blood sugar, increased blood lipids, the combination of which just leads to increased fat and a dysfunctional metabolism. So what can we really do about this? Well, we have to, again, incorporate the natural colors from our diet to increase these gut hormones, but not restrict ourselves with food. Just eat natural, whole, real foods, which would be vegetables, fruit, lean protein, nuts and seeds. And if you do that, you don't need to worry about counting calories. You don't need to worry about how many carbs am I getting, what's the type of protein. Just, you know, eat three solid meals a day and eat the majority of your food, bigger meals for breakfast and lunch and a smaller dinner, and exercise and move and balance your stress and go to sleep at the same time every night. And you're going to see over time that you're going to lose body fat and so forth. So I think that's a take-home message. And lastly, studies have shown that even nutritionists, PhDs, and they do study nutrition for a living, can't even count calories. It's too cumbersome, and they know this stuff inside and out. So the biggest thing that I would love for people to understand is you're not going to win doing that. You're just going to drive yourself crazy.
I agree. I totally agree. And you're right about not, you know, counting calories is like, it's just a chore. Unless you can carry around a little unit that measures your food and puts it all in and does the analysis for you, they haven't come up with that yet. You can't really. You just kind of estimate. And most of the time people are grossly off when they do it. I mean, the only way to do it is to have a diet that's already been laid out, pre-measured, and has all of it. And nobody wants to follow that. So the other thing that comes up also is the whole concept of leptin. And if you could talk a little bit about leptin, and does ghrelin come in here, and how did those tie into this whole equation?
Yeah, let's talk about ghrelin first. This is one of these gut-derived hormones again. And what we see with in lean individuals, ghrelin spikes before a meal, and it's kind of like the gas pedal to drive appetite. So people that eat very consistent regular meals, that means breakfast, lunch, dinner, on consistent times, ghrelin spikes beforehand. So the body loves consistency. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And when people, you know, skip breakfast, skip lunch, eat a big dinner, don't eat breakfast, and kind of bounce around and have inconsistent meal patterns, what happens is ghrelin is permanently high. And so in so doing, the appetite centers in the brain become dysfunctional. So they're chronically hungry and tend to overeat and overconsume. So the biggest thing to keep in mind is just be very consistent with your meal timing throughout the day, and definitely don't skip meals. Don't skip lunch. Don't skip breakfast. Those are very important. And so that's what the research really shows. Now, in terms of leptin, this is really a fun one to talk about, because leptin does so much and way more than we ever understood. And this could be a whole book and 3 days of talking in and of itself. But to try and simplify it, leptin is kind of like the gas gauge on your car. And it's a hormone released from fat tissue. And it's going to be lowest in, you know, the mid-morning, roughly 10 to 12 a.m., you know, something like that, right? 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., sorry. And just like when your gas gauge on your car is empty, you're going to go refuel. So that would be like on your way to work, you're going to stop and get gas in the morning. On your way home, you already got gas, you're full, then you don't need to refuel. And that's kind of what happens in the body. Your leptin level should rise gradually throughout the day. And in the evening, it should be at its highest level. And that would tell you, your body, that you don't need to refuel, you don't need to eat. The problem, though, with many hormones is that when their levels become super physiologic or high, you know, very elevated, the receptors that recognize and sense these hormones they start to ignore or they downregulate the message. And so in individuals that have a lot of fat, particularly belly fat, they become leptin resistant. And all that really means is it's almost as though leptin is not there. There's so much leptin that the receptors basically are shutting the door. They're not listening to the message. Now, that's problematic because that means that individuals are going to be chronically hungry. They're going to eat excessively at dinner, which is really bad because, of course, you go to bed shortly after that and you have all this food sitting in your GI tract, which is going to be fermented by all these bacteria. And they are really good at harvesting energy. So that's really a problem because you can actually put on more body fat that way. But the real problem with leptin is it messes with our immune system. And we have this very protective cell type called the T regulatory cell. And this is something that there's, you know, a couple things you want to take away from this call. This is one. I'm going to say it again. The T regulatory cell is going to help you prevent cancer, help you prevent cardiovascular disease, help you prevent diabetes and Alzheimer's and autoimmunity. It's like the policeman or the SWAT team of your immune system. So if you have little fights and riots and, say free radical stress in your thyroid, the T regulatory cell is going to break that up and calm things down. The problem, though, is leptin wipes out the T reg cells. So all these little fights and riots and things are going on in all of our bodies all day long. They spiral out of control, and that manifests as asthma, skin disorders, acne, diabetes, autoimmunity, MS, RA, anything that you can think of. And so that's why we see individuals with increased body fat, they have elevated levels of leptin, and they also have a lot of co-occurring autoimmune inflammatory disorders. So the real reason why I think it's important to balance your gut and do exercises and lifestyle strategies to burn fat is not only so you look good, you know, naked or on the beach or something like that, is to prevent you from these diseases that will end up shortening your lifespan. So the leptin monkeys with the Treg cells, that drives inflammation. What we can do is reduce the body fat, reduce leptin, and improve the function of our immune system, and we won't have all these inflammatory disorders.
So give us, if you would, some more information about how to reduce leptin, because it feels like, yeah, reduce body fat, right? So we're saying your body fat is high because of these hormonal imbalance, and to bring the leptin levels down, you need to reduce the body fat, but, like, you know, it's the whole chicken and the egg thing. What are some other ways to reduce leptin?
Perfect, yeah. Well, leptin is released in a rhythmic fashion. So basically like the rise and fall of the sun, you know, and what we want to do, all these hormones oscillate in our body. For example, cortisol is highest in the morning. Testosterone in men is highest in the morning. Melatonin rises at night. What's really important is to restore the biological rhythm of leptin. So first, start by going to bed at around 10 o'clock, turning off the lights. No iPhone, no TV, no movies. You just turn out the lights, read a book, and fall asleep by 10:30, and get up at 6 or 6:30, and be very consistent with that. Because if your biological rhythm gets in order, you can restore the normal oscillation of leptin, which can help to improve the physiology of leptin. So that's number one. Exercising first thing in the morning on an empty stomach, particularly for women, is a great thing to help burn fat. And this is something that I learned from being in the fitness world before I got into all the functional medicine stuff, is bodybuilders and fitness models, they can reliably get their body fat down to under 5%, like every year after year. I mean, this is like, you know, clockwork for them. How do they do it? Well, they eat a big breakfast, eat a big lunch, eat a small dinner, and cut the carbs in the afternoon. So that's one thing that you can do, is just eat your carbohydrates in your high-calorie food, if you're going to eat that type of food, if you're active, for example, in the middle part of the day, and then exercise in the morning on an empty stomach. And if you can, have a little bit of caffeine like green tea or coffee to help liberate some of these stored fat that you want to burn in your muscle tissue. The other thing that we can do to balance leptin is, of course, look at the gut level. So something that we didn't really talk about, but when you have leaky gut and you have that gram-negative bacteria like H. pylori and E. coli, that endotoxin component found on that bacteria, it causes leptin resistance. So again, it goes back to restoring the gut health with a high-fiber phytochemical diet, taking these herbs and botanicals like berberine, curcumin, and resveratrol, block that, because if you do have this leaky gut going on, you're by default going to have leptin resistance. There's this complex biochemical pathway by which these gut bacteria cause leptin resistance. So, you know, I think just doing the exercises, eating a lot of your meals during the day, balancing your circadian clock and balancing your gut is a great first step to really not only shedding fat, but restoring your body's normal physiology.
Mm-hmm. Good point. You know, we get a lot of people who feel like they have to eat something before they exercise. There's a lot of, you know, go get the little goo packs and have a performance beverage before you go exercise. And that actually sounds like it's counterintuitive or counterproductive for the goal.
Well, I would say unless you're getting paid to exercise, then you don't need to refuel that much. I used to be a competitive bike racer and raced with a lot of, you know, people that ended up doing the Tour de France and things like that. And we would go on 4 or 6 hour bike rides in the mountains in Colorado, hundreds of miles up and down hills. And the most I would bring is like a banana, you know? And so I see these people that would get into cycling, you know, and they would be on our group rides, and they, just like you said, Dr. Rita Marie, they would take goos and they would have energy bars and they'd have these drinks with 100 grams of sugar in each one of them, and they started training. They actually gained weight. They're doing more exercise than they've ever done, and they're fatter than they've ever been, and they're confused, perplexed, like, how am I gaining weight? I'm burning 3,000 calories a day doing these long training rides, and it's like, well, you know, you just can't eat that stuff. And so what happens is, you know, if you really want to access fat, you need to do high intensity training, but also cardiovascular based training on an empty stomach, because that's really where you can liberate these fat stores, get the fat into the mitochondria where it's burned, and really change your body composition.
Fantastic to hear. So I want to ask you, people ask me this all the time, and I want to see how consistent we are in our answers, is that how long after exercising does that matter? Because some of the research I looked at said that, you know, the growth hormone elevates while you're exercising, and it can stay elevated for 90 minutes. And when you're in growth hormone surge, you don't have insulin, you burn fat, you store lean. Do you have a particular rule of thumb with that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I generally recommend, you know, if you're doing aerobic-based or cardio, so to speak, the eating afterwards is not really so important. I would say sometime within an hour after. But when you're doing strength training, which I highly recommend, and I know for the women listening, that can be something scary or something that, you know, we tend to think that just men need to lift weights, but the elderly, women, kids, I think everyone needs to lift weights, because mm-hmm. the more lean muscle mass you have, the more fat you're going to burn. And I alluded to it, but there's this type of cell called, well, it's a subcell, a cell within a cell, if you will, called the mitochondria. And this is really where our cells make energy and so on. And the mitochondrial density is highest in muscle tissue. And muscle tissue is where we burn fat. So the more lean muscle mass you have, the more fat you're going to burn just sitting at your desk at work, for example. And particularly while you're exercising, if you have a lot of lean muscle mass, when you exercise, you're going to be very efficient at putting those fuels into the furnace and burning them for energy. So along those lines, that's your question. If you're doing strength-based training, again, which everyone should be doing, you really should eat and have some amino acid-rich protein and moderately high glycemic index carbohydrates. My favorite would be berries and half a banana as soon as you can after you work out. So that would be, let's say you get up at 6, you get to the gym, come back 7:30, you're doing a smoothie with whey or pea protein immediately after. And that's going to get all those nutrients to your muscle tissue. It's going to help repair and rebuild muscle and recover the glycogen stores that you depleted during your workout. So those strength training, eat right away. Cardiovascular-based training is not as important.
Hmm. Cool. And so you don't think that affects the growth hormone levels?
You know, from what I've seen, and there's a lot of research coming out on this right now, is studies show that by eating high glycemic meals with little protein immediately after high intensity training, it leads to beneficial hormonal changes. So in theory, I see what you're saying, where, you know, you really don't want carbs and growth hormone taken at the same time and so forth, but it's been shown to enhance recovery, reduce cortisol, because cortisol is very catabolic, will break down your muscle tissue. So that's where I stand. I've had good results recommending this, and personally, so that's where I stand. But again, I could be wrong. The science is always changing on this.
It's always changing, and I think that it really comes down to understanding the science, but then applying it and do the trial and error. Because I think we're our own best labs is your own body. You know what I mean? To just really try it and see. And for some people, it may work better, and there may be some metabolic differences that it for others it doesn't. So, cool. Great. Well,
point.
I think we covered all the things I wanted to ask you about, and I know that we have people on the line, and I wanted to check in with Lynn to see if any questions have come in. I don't see any hands raised, but maybe there's some people who have typed in questions on the web. So, Lynn?
Yes, we do have a question. So you had talked about three different things to do to treat the gut. One was the berberine, and another was the oil of oregano, and the third one got lost in there. And go ahead.
Peppermint oil.
Okay. And then the other question was, is there a preferential probiotic for those who have diabetes?
Yeah, great point. So two that I would recommend. We talked about the bifidobacterium. You know, those are the strains you want to focus on. one company that I like to recommend, Zymogen, is a great brand. They have a high-dose bifidobacterium-based probiotic called ProBioMax. So that would be one that I'd recommend. And I've done a lot of research out there, and they're the company that has the highest percentage of bifidobacterium that I've seen. There may be new ones out there, but right now that's the highest. The other strain that's beneficial, it's actually a probiotic yeast called Saccharomyces boulardii, or SACB, or S. boulardii. We generally, a lot of practitioners and a lot of people in the medical community have linked Saccharomyces boulardii with a reduction in what's known as Clostridium difficile or traveler's diarrhea, which is just the tip of the iceberg. Saccharomyces boulardii does so many beneficial changes in the GI tract, improves immunoglobulin production, reduces gut permeability. And since writing the book and recommending Sac Boulardii in the book, I've received a lot of emails, a lot of Facebook and Twitter messages from women, actually, that have no kidding, I've gotten pictures on Instagram of dramatic improvements in belly fat. So for individuals that may have candida, which, you know, is a whole nother can of worms, Sac Boulardii is one that I would definitely include into the mix. And a lot of research is emerging on this. It does so much more than just traveler's diarrhea. So, again, bifidobacterium and Saccharomyces boulardii.
Do you have, say, recommended dosages or dose range? Does that vary from person to person?
You know, that's a great point. On the probiotics, generally we're looking at a minimum of 30 billion CFU colony-forming units per dose. Now, again, it's all strain-specific, so certain strains have been studied at lower doses. For example, there's probiotics that you can take to enhance the microbiome, if you will, in your mouth, and those are a lot lower doses. But, you know, for weight loss and metabolic improvements and helping to burn belly fat, I would say start at around 30 billion. You can go up to a trillion, which is a lot, I know. But, you know, if folks listening go to the health food store and they see 1 million, that may sound like a lot, but it's really dose, you know, efficacy doesn't start until it's in the billions. So that's
right.
Something to keep in mind. And on the Sac Boulardii specifically, 10 billion CFU is what's been shown to be effective.
Okay. And is it weight dependent?
That's a great point. But studies that I looked at for Sac Boulardii didn't, weight wasn't a variable, but I think children wouldn't have to do as much, you know, a lot smaller and so forth. So,
yeah.
Great point, but again, like you said, we're all so unique and individual.
Right.
So just experiment with yourself, and if you don't see any results, then tweak it, increase the dose, or
exactly.
Take it at different times.
Exactly, great. Well, I see somebody has a hand up. Let me reopen that line, and then I want to, before we do that, let's just share with people your book, where they can find it, your videos, your website. So where do people go if they want to learn more?
Yeah, thank you for that. Bellyfateffect.com, and that's EFFECT, bellyfateffect.com. And there's, as you mentioned, Dr. Rita Marie, free video series there. So I've done a lot of webinars geared to healthcare practitioners, but they are, you know, anyone can listen to them. They're very educational. We don't go too fast. We talk about leptin, we talk about belly fat, we talk about gut bacteria and food and so forth. So if you want that audiovisual component, that's available to you for free. And the book is available pretty much anywhere books are sold. It's in on Amazon. There's a Kindle version. There's a, you know, we can ship you a book from Amazon directly, and also Barnes & Noble and on the Nook and so forth. So anywhere books are sold, that's, again, Belly Fat Effect is the name of the book by Mike Mutzel.
Great. Great. And we have a link for you to make it easy. Just click the link on the page, and it'll get you to his website. That's how I got there. So let me open up this line. It's 562 is the area code. So go ahead and tell us your name and ask your question.
Hello, Dr. Rita Marie. This is Barb. How are you?
Oh, well, wonderful, Barb.
Hello.
Nice to hear you.
Good. Thank you very much. I'm very excited about this topic, and I don't know whether, is it Mutzel?
Mutzel, yeah, not a doctor, just a nutrition geek, if you will.
Just a fabulously informed guy, that's what I'll say.
Yeah.
Right.
I had a question regarding, or my question surrounds when you were talking about when yo-yo dieters who permanently damage their hormone. I didn't quite understand that part. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, great point, great question. So according to research, you know, we've known that yo-yo dieting empirically is not a good thing, but the modern science shows that the way that yo-yo dieting may cause people to permanently have more weight gain over the long run than before they started dieting is because they monkey with the gut hormones. And again, this was several different studies that have teased this out, but we have some 26 different hormones released from our intestine. They're critical for blood sugar balance, for regulating appetite and satiety. And when you go low-calorie, high-calorie, low-calorie, high-calorie, and bounce around, there's a long-time suppression. I don't know if it's permanent or semi-permanent or what have you, but these hormones get suppressed. And at the end of the day, that leads to increased appetite cravings and impaired blood sugar regulation. So it's very important to don't diet, just, you know, eat the right foods and exercise, balance your stress, and get to bed at the right time every day will lead to a more permanent improvement in your body composition and overall health.
Well, thank you for that. That's encouraging.
That's great.
I thought maybe I misunderstood, because I thought you were talking about, I don't quite have it fixed in my head, so I apologize. But Dr. Rita Marie, you've been talking about these fabulous things that get T something that gets smaller as we get older. And so do you know what that is?
Telomeres.
Telomeres, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, what you're talking about, Mike, that's not affecting the telomeres at all?
You know, there may be some connection there, but these are really these what they're called gut hormones. So telomeres are like the protective caps on the, you know, the DNA and the chromosomes inside of your cells. And maybe there's a correlation there. But, yeah, we're really talking about when you oscillate how much food you eat, you know, and do a lot of these, you know, low-calorie diets for 4 weeks and then you bounce back and gain a bunch of weight. That's what we're talking about. And it really affects these gut hormones. And, again, that's so important because even before you sit down and start chewing your food, these gut hormones should be releasing. They speak to the pancreas, which is the organ that releases insulin that's so critical for balancing blood sugar. So that's really what it comes down to. These hormones are just so powerful at regulating our entire metabolic physiology, and so that you don't want to screw them up. You know, you don't want to keep doing these yo-yo diets because that can lead to, you know, semi-permanent changes in your metabolism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, thank you.
Great question.
Yeah, and just to the whole telomere issue, I mean, I think that the connection would be, you know, we find that there's lots of things that damage telomeres. And this kind of a diet maintains the telomeres, not necessarily increases them. There are certain botanicals that have been shown to actually lengthen them. But it is the exposure to the standard American diet loaded with processed fats and processed carbs and chemicals and all this stuff that actually does damage the telomeres. So you can, first of all, to help those telomeres, is follow what Mike's been talking about, is that high fiber, high phytonutrient diet is going to be helping in protecting your telomeres as well.
I see.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm so glad you came on the show, Mike. Thank you.
Well, thank you. This was a lot of fun. Anytime.
Me too. It's great. And we have 90 seconds. We just heard the lady warn us so that we have 90 seconds left. Thank you, Barb, for great questions. You always have great questions.
Thank you.
I think that, you know, we should wrap up and just leave people with, you know, some takeaways. Like, what, if somebody's listening to this, you've shared a lot of stuff. I was feverishly taking notes, and I can imagine someone who's not as highly trained as I am just really taking a lot of notes. I would highly recommend you go back and listen to this again and get Mike's book. But what are, like, 1, 2, 3 takeaways from here that you would say, absolutely, let's get started?
I love that. Yeah, so before you eat, you want to be in a mindful state, and that's going to activate your gut and turn on all these hormones, turn on digestion, which is so critical. Impaired digestion leads to imbalances in your gut microflora, imbalances in gut hormones. So be calm and centered before you eat. Number
Thank
two,
you. And I didn't
really
pay him to say that, guys. The people are in my programs that hear me say that. I didn't pay him to say that. So go ahead. Go continue.
Nice. Yeah, number two is chew your food. It sounds so simple and elementary, but no kidding. Studies have shown that people that don't chew their food very thoroughly, and the right number is 40 chews per swallow. What does that look like in real life? Just be the slowest one at the table. If you're sitting down with your family, try to be the last person to clear your plate. That's just a very easy way to do it. So take some, you know, put your fork down and just chew, talk to your spouse or your children, and don't watch TV or be on your iPhone. Number three, exercise first thing in the morning on an empty stomach. Really get your heart rate going and create some oxygen debt. Number four, balance your stress. So this is very, very critical. Do some yoga or heart math. Number five, go to sleep at the same time every night. Turn out the lights. Number six, eat a lot of fiber, a lot of color, and I think you're going to be okay.
Wow, you got double. We got double that. And we cut off right in the middle. We cut this so the people that were listening on the web. So, Lynn, if you could go ahead and just tell those folks that they can come back once the recording is up and listen to that last part. But they're probably going to want to listen to the whole thing again. So
sure.
Thank you. This is awesome. I so appreciate you being here. I can't wait to dig into your book. And it's like half of it is references. So I'm a geek about references. I want to know, why is he saying that? I can always look it up. So you said
nice.
So many of the things that I say over and over and over again. You didn't even say anything. You didn't even include the herbs and all that other stuff. It was the foundations is what I like to talk about. It's the foundational things that set us up for good digestion and for a healthy microbiome and for healthy hormones in the digestive tract. So awesome, awesome. I look forward to speaking to you again really soon, and thank you so very much. So get out there and check out Belly Fat Effect by Mike Mutzel, and you can click on the link there and you'll get it, and watch his videos. So thank you, Mike.
Awesome. Thank you. Have a wonderful evening, everyone. Dr. Rita Marie, thank you so much. This was so much fun. So take care.
You're so welcome. It was a lot of fun for me, too. Bye-bye
awesome.
Now.
All right. Bye-bye.
And everybody else, take care. And our next show will be coming up with another great speaker next week. So tune in and watch and if you want to sign up for being a friend, and then you'll get notices every time we set up a new show. But thank you very much, and bye-bye.